to phonemes and morphemes, which they are then systematically recombining at random into every conceivable permutation. Nails sniffed. Recombining. In any way they can, Kiss said. Ciphering, deciphering, transliterating, substituting. They're forcing the raw material through patterns of anagram, acrostic, pangram, hell, rhymes, for all I know. At the most basic level, they are taking every morpheme and trying it against every other possible combination of morphemes. And every now and then, they get a strike. They get a piece of enuncia that they can identify and secure into. Well, I suppose they are producing some kind of primer program.
And like completing a puzzle, I said, the more pieces they get, the more help it gives them finding the rest.
Wait, wait, said Carl, getting to his feet. I understand what you're saying, but you're talking about a massive undertaking. Truly massive. Just handling that amount of data and processing it randomly, that would take thousands of years.
But it could be done, I said. Remember the old joke about giving an infinite number of simians, an infinite number of script engines, and eventually, probability demands, they would produce the complete works of Vaton. Carl looked at me.
Yeah, and the bit of that to really remember is that it's a joke. Maybe not an infinite number of simians, Kiss said. But how about the entire administratum of a subsector capital? Millions of scribes using, as far as we know, at least 5 million cogitators brought in from the mergent worlds. 60 main system data looms. 60?
Carl breathed.
It suddenly sounds more plausible, doesn't it? Kiss smiled. And for the most part, those infinite simians have no idea what they're doing. They're just drones, processing what comes in front of them. Oh, every now and then, one has a fit because he's accidentally found or created a piece of enuncia, but the Ministry have supervisors on hand to cover that.
Well, I suppose that would explain why the data you fed me made no discernible sense, said Carl. And then fried my engines. They must be using the imported cogitators because they're polluted, perhaps more resistant to the material they are handling.
Or more sensitive, I said.
I have, as it might be, a query.
We all looked round. Since arriving with Kiss, Unworth had sat in the corner of the chamber, with Belknap cleaning and dressing his miserable injuries. I regretted, yet again, that another individual had suffered because of their association with me.
What, beggaring the question, he said, is this enuncia? And please, sir, do not obstinate me to be excluding my nasal from your business for the good of my health.
I winced at that, and moved over to face him. Enuncia is the name ancient scholars gave to a lost pre-human language, Master Unworth. Its origins and use may have associations to the warp itself, or to antique super-races that may once have existed in our cosmos. Tiny scraps of it have occasionally been discovered. We don't know how it was created originally, or even used. It's possibly the source of the arts we now understand as magic. Simply put, the language was a tool, an instrument. By the power of words alone, the fabric of reality could be changed, transformed, controlled, manipulated, reshaped. It was a fundamental device of creation.
Or destruction, Kiss added. That sound you made,
Unworth said to Kiss.
In the cell, the one by which manner you discomfited our jailer. That was enuncia.
A tiny part of it, probably a meaningless unit, Kiss replied. But yes.
Unworth thought about that.
I have turned words around in my lifetime, but I have never by wit of them enforced a man to be ill upon the floor.
You say that, Nail grinned.
How did you know it?
Unworth asked. We've encountered it before, I said. Some years ago, we were engaged in the pursuit of a heretic called Moloch. His ambition was to recover enough elements of enuncia from xeno-archaeological sites in the outworlds to master a rudimentary command of it. Patience actually infiltrated his party for some time, enabling us to track them down and stop them. Moloch was killed.
Moloch was cognate, said Patience. Should we be concerned that several figures in this drama have the same connection?
We should bear it in mind, I said. Either cognate agents are making a second attempt to break enuncia, or this is a direct sequel to Moloch's work.
And what will Trice or his occult masters do with enuncia when they have it?
Asked Nail. I would suppose, I said, anything they like. A buzzer sounded. The outer door.
I'll get it, Fraukas said, rising and stubbing out another low stick.
garters and firm white buttocks. Everyone looked at him, even Belknap. "Sorry, just reading aloud," said Frauke, putting his data slate down. "My, the power of words." It was Kara, the final member of my team, to congregate in the formal J undersink. She was accompanied by a dark-haired woman with an attractive face that at present looked drawn and tired. "This is Maud Pleiten," said Kara. "Junior Marshal, Magistratum." "Department of Special Crime," Pleiten said. She was staring at my armored chair dubiously. "Ravana," I replied. The forward shell of my chair displayed my rosette. "Maud may be the only member of her department left alive," Kara said. "Special Crime made a chance discovery a few days ago, a discovery the Ministry has been at such pains to cover up that it has silenced many members of the department. Attempts have been made on Maud's life. Her invalid uncle was murdered in one of them." "I'm sorry to hear that," I said. "Can you tell me what this discovery was?" "Yes," Pleiten replied. She had a sheaf of documents under her arm. "It will take a little time to explain. The discovery was made in the old sacristy, adjoining the Grand Templum."
"Informal A," I finished. "Could it be, by any chance, that's also where the two of you met?"
Kara shot me a wicked grin.
"Zale, huh? How about that?"
"Kara, Marshal Pleiten, I'm keen to hear everything you have to tell me. But first, Kara, I need to talk to you about Zale and Zeph."
Chapter 4. For Yeda Trice, the day of days began early. He had trained his body and mind over the years to require only 3 or 4 hours sleep, but on this auspicious night he snatched just 1 frail hour. His hand servants woke him at the 3rd bell, with night still sprawled across the city and dawn another 4 hours away. The servants lit the lamps in his apartments, bathed and dressed him, and brought him his breakfast. As per the instructions he had written himself, the bathing water was without tincture or oils, and the clothes were a simple attire of dark grey. He put on no rings or signets, nor marks of wealth or status. The only concession he made was his fine pocket cron. In due course, that would have to be set aside too, but for now he needed to keep a careful record of the passage of time. His breakfast eschewed the caffeine, freshly baked sugar bread, and conserve he usually favoured. The servants presented him with ripe fruit, evergrass tea, and some wheat biscuits. As he ate, half-heartedly, sitting at his bureau and reading the first of the day's dispatches brought to him by his seneschal, he realized how utterly despondent he felt. This was a day, a moment, he had been dreaming of for over 25 years. He'd been planning for it for the last 15, and actively working towards it for the whole of the previous decade. Trice prided himself on a precision of labor, on patience, on attention to detail. He hadn't risen to the rank of chief provost without those skills, and, fate knew, they were essential for the matter in hand. The first annunciation, the commencing rite of transcendence. He had planned every last detail with meticulous care, even down to the weave pattern to be used in the ritual clothing. This wasn't a matter of carefully arranging a private ceremony, like the cabals and seances he and his fellow cognite initiates had conducted in their Skolam days. This was on a scale unimaginable back then. This was orchestration. And now, after all the fastidious preparation, all that planning, all that discipline, he found he was being rushed into it, the Diadochoi's unseemly haste. This was wrong. With the lexicon so close to completion, why were they risking failure by advancing the moment of the first enunciation so recklessly? Trice toyed with the last piece of fruit, and considered getting to his feet, climbing up to the residence, and demanding that the Diadochoi reconsider. Surely he could be made to listen to reason. No, of course not. One did not reason with a man like the Diadochoi. Once the master's mind was decided, nothing would change it. And now that bastard facilitator, the honey-tongued Kulzean, had the Diadochoi's ear, egging him on. Kulzean was an expediter. By the very nature of his profession, he made things happen in the quickest, most direct way. All very clever, Orfeo Kulzean, but an enunciation could not be brought to fruition by following the path of least resistance. It should not be rushed or forced. It should not be expedited. It was far too pure and intricate an event for that. 45 minutes after Trice had been woken, a colonel of the Eustace Majoris Planetary Defense Force arrived at the governor's palace in a military pinnace, escorted by 4 lifter gunships. He had come directly from PDF Watch Command, Station Lupercal, a star fort in geosynchronous orbit above Petropolis. He was attired in full-dress uniform and carried a locked dispatch box that was chained to his wrist. The secretists accompanied him to the chief provost's chambers. Revoke personally led the man in and stood back while the colonel presented himself.
"At your bidding, my lord," the officer announced, putting the box on the floor, snapping to attention and making the salute of the Aquila.
"The Emperor protects," Trice replied, rising to his feet. "Good morning. You have the weather station reports and the global attitude?"
"Yes, lord. Reports as of midnight, equatorial, with a 36-hour plot as commanded. Attitude was calculated by the officers of the watch at Lupercal, Frailes, Entropy, and Kuskin stations, triangulated via Astropath through Navy flotillas at Caxton, Lenk, Tancred, and Gudrun. The attitude was further confirmed by Adeptus Astrocartographicus at the deep relay discerner at Kobish, the massive circular array at Lockmore Heights, and the Christoph Kartan Observatory.
Margin of error?
Decimal 0002, sir.
Trice nodded. The colonel picked up the box, unlocked it with the code, and handed the chief provost a small yellow data tile.
"Thank you, colonel."
"Thank you, sir." The colonel saluted and left the chamber. Trice sat back down and slid the tile into the cogitator beside his desk. The screen lit, and data scrolled down it. It was a projection of Eustace Majoris's precise sidereal alignment, the planet's position in space described as exactly as Imperial science could establish. Trice tracked forward and watched the screen resolve the relative plot developing through the course of 36 hours. Then he overlaid the weather mapping and watched it again.
"Damn," he whispered at last.
"A problem?" Revoke asked.
"No," said Trice, "and that's the problem. Positional variance is excellent, and the weather suits us too. We've actually chanced upon a tertiary-level alignment. A good one, as it happens. Phasic spread is almost secondary in quality. Gods, a week ago this data would have suggested an abysmal alignment tonight. But now we factor in the true center, it's..."
"Perfect," Revoke suggested.
"Perfect happens once every 16,000 years, Taurus. Extremely fine, once every 500. We knew we wouldn't hold out for that degree of alignment. By the old calculations, we estimated we'd get a good around midwinter. Now it appears we have an acceptable tonight. At the 8th hour plus 6, precisely. What are those odds, do you suppose?" "It's almost as if he knew."
"Maybe he did," Revoke said.
"Maybe he did,"
Trice echoed.
"I don't understand your displeasure," Revoke said. "If tonight is propitious, why are you so disappointed?"
Trice ejected the yellow tile from his engine and held it up.
"I was hoping the auguries would be poor, my friend. If they were poor, I might have used them to convince the Diadochoi to delay the ritual. He understands facts, and he doesn't argue with them. It was my last hope. But the predictions are good, so I can't."
"You really hoped for a postponement?" Trice nodded.
"I did, Taurus. I really did. This is too fast, too rushed."
"Everything is in place, sir."
"Of course it is. I made it so. But I designed this moment. So long, so hard. And now I find myself rushed into it at a day's notice."
Revoke looked at the floor.
"I'm sorry to hear that, sir.
I hate to see your disappointment. Maybe I could speak with the Diadochoi on your behalf?"
Trice smiled. "There's no point, Taurus. The first of my sealed orders have already been opened, haven't they?"
"Yes, sir."
"The first function's already underway?"
"Yes, sir."
"Then the rock is already rolling, and woe betide any who stand in its way. Even a chief provost. Let me say now, before it's too late, I am heartened by your staunch loyalty. I may not get a chance to tell you that later."
Revoke looked awkward.
"Thank you, sir," he said.
Trice rose and tossed the yellow tile to Revoke. Revoke caught it neatly.
"The geometricians will be needing that. Have the data routed to all elements. 8th hour plus 6. As of this moment, the Ministry stands at condition delta. If we're going to be forced to do this, we'd better do it well."
"Yes, sir."
"Begin the masses."
"They've already started," Taurus Revoke replied. Out across the hive,
Temple bells were pealing in the pre-dawn dark, calling the faithful to prayer. Most temples in the hive half-filled with the usual bleary attendees, coming to worship out of habit and duty. But that morning, 999 city temples were packed with capacity congregations of citizens who had been up, dressed, and ready hours before the dawn service. For 3.5 years, the secretists had been running private masses in these 999 churches. Ostensibly imperial in nature, these masses were a skillful and insidious process of conditioning. A variety of methods had been employed, not the least being the fact that the temple bells had been subtly retimed so that their peals created a subliminal call that lured the congregation in. In the first few months, the secretists had vetted the congregations and quietly removed any worshippers who registered as unreceptive or unsuitable on their biometric scans. Then the clerics in charge of the masses had begun to drop mesmeric subtext into the services, using ciphered forms of enuncia, conditioning the congregations into absolute cooperation. Not a single man or woman amongst the worshippers even suspected that the masses they were participating in were anything but the imperial creed. On that morning, that day of days, no one in those 999 churches so much as blinked when the clerics slid open their triptychs and displayed not the God Emperor and his saints, but stark, almost psychedelic symbols of enuncia. Nor did they hear the words they were actually saying. And these were not low-hab, ill-educated people so preyed upon. Many of the private masses were held in temples that served high-born populations. Nobles, academics, lawyers, educators, merchants, magistrates, civil servants of note. One particular church, St. Philomel Highstack, was the one preferred by the officio inquisitoris planetia, and thus over 100 interrogators, explicators, and other ordo servants had been inducted. This had delighted the Diadochoi particularly. It had been a recurring question as to how the Inquisition could be contained and muzzled during the preparations for enunciation, and simply by dint of geography, because of the temple they used, the Inquisition had not only muzzled itself, but had become active participants in the event. A cosmic irony, the Diadochoi had called it. The location of the 999 chosen temples was no accident. If lines were drawn through them on a chart of Petropolis, they defined precise, invisible axes across the city plan. To a casual eye, a plan of the hive looked like a shapeless, unstructured thing, a complex blotch of intersecting stack streets and overlapping wards. But when such lines were drawn, as they had been drawn on the hyper-accurate chart on the floor of the Encompass Room, they revealed a peculiar, almost beautiful symmetry to the city layout. They revealed its planned and exquisitely formulated perfection. They revealed its design, not as a place of habitation and commerce, but as a vast and complex mechanism. Trice rechecked the time on his pocket chron. Sunrise was now just 6 minutes away. In the previous 35 minutes, he had conducted a series of final briefings with some of the key operation groups. First, with the 8-man team of secretists, who would fly out just after dawn and travel to Carbonopolis, the second city of Eustace Majoris, a sprawling, balkanized hive near the southern pole. There, through the course of the day, they would plant and detonate a series of devices and leak disinformation, suggesting a systematic program of cult attacks. By nightfall, there would be a state of global emergency, with Carbonopolis the focus of attention for the PDF, the planet's Imperial Guard garrisons, and the Navy. Misdirection on the grandest scale. Then Trice had briefed the chiefs of the Ministry's technical departments, whose task later in the day would be to hijack, by means of cogitation, digitation, and vox, all of Petropolis's newscasts, air networks, audio caster systems, and sundry picked channels. Some would be shut down, others would be set to broadcast specially prepared materials that would be given to the chiefs nearer to time. Trice had then moved to his next meeting, reading, as he walked, the latest clutch of dispatches that Revoke handed him. For a moment, he felt exhilarated to see the absolutely sublime way his long-prepared plan was being executed. Every last detail slotting into place, just as he had designed it. Then his burning despondency had returned. The haste. The foolish haste. The third briefing had been with the 80-strong team of secretists, under Ptolemy's command, who would raid the central hive premises of the Astropathicus during the late afternoon. They would pose as officers of the Inquisition,
and the cover story would be a suspected chaos taint connected to the incident at the diplomatic palace. Heavy-duty inhibitor units would be set up at each Astropath center, and by late evening, all legal telepathic activity in and around the hive would be blunted. Now it was 6 minutes to sunrise. At a nod from Trice, Revoke opened the doors into the climate-controlled vault of the Cypherists. The Perfecti, a dozen men in long green robes, were ready and waiting for him. They bowed and made their formal greeting. "Are they prepared?" Trice asked. The senior Perfectus, a wizened man called Mataray, beckoned the chief provost over and showed him the long rows of sealed desks in which the anonymic wafers had been laid out, each one covered by an opaquing field. There were 999 of them. At the end of the afternoon, they would each be hermetically sealed into inert envelopes, placed in carrying coffers, and sent out by secretist dispatchers to the 999 axial churches and temples. "The wafers have been checked?" Trice asked.
"Nine times each one," said Perfectus Mataray. "To such a close degree of scrutiny, eight of the Perfecti have suffered mental damage. Two have died."
"The efforts of the Cypherists will not be forgotten," Trice assured him. "This is an extraordinary achievement. This is the articulation of apotheosis for all of us." Mataray nodded.
"It is a shame, Lord, that we had to do this so quickly. We would not have sustained injuries and losses if we had been given more time to complete the ciphering."
Trice nodded. Again, he thought, the Diadochoi's haste. The purity of my plan ruffled by his demands. There lay the core of his despondency. There had been a time when Trice's great scheme had already been well developed and underway, when there had been no Diadochoi to factor in. 5 years ago. 5 years, was that all it was? 5 years before, Trice's intricate and occult network of intimates and contacts had introduced him to the hideously disfigured man, and so, almost by happenstance, brokered their partnership. The man's brilliance and immeasurable talents had been too useful for Trice to reject. The plan had instantly taken a quantum leap forward and become something momentous and grand, everything Trice had ever hoped for, but never believed possible. And he had become chief provost, and the disfigured man had become Oscar Ludolf Barazan, Lord Governor Subsector, and together, through labor and genius and deceit, they had ascended the gleaming ladder of destiny to this day of days. "Chief Provost," Revoke said, "it's sunrise." Trice came out of his reverie. "Sunrise, and still so much to do." "The officers of deliberation await you in the east wing," Revoke reminded him.
"I'm coming," Trice said.
He nodded to the Perfecti.
"Your work astonishes and delights me, and the Diadochoi thanks you for your pains."
The Perfecti bowed. As they marched out of the vault, Trice glanced at Revoke.
"Sunrise, you say? Stand the ministry at condition gamma."
Revoke pulled out his hand vox. "This is Revoke on the command channel. Condition gamma. Repeat, we are at condition gamma."
"Hey, where are you going?" Kara said.
"It's dawn song," replied Belknap, pulling on his coat. "Can't you hear the bells?"
"Yeah, they woke me,"
she yawned. "Here's an idea. Why don't you come with me?" Kara shook her head.
"Plighton and I have got to brief the Inquisitor at breakfast," she said. "Do you have to go?"
"Yes," Belknap said, very directly.
"Oh, it appears to me that you're a very devout person, aren't you, Belknap?"
"I suppose. Is there something wrong with that?" She shrugged. They were standing in the doorway of the lockup. Everyone inside was asleep, except Carl, who was toying with Belknap's cogitator. The sink streets were quiet at last, just empty walkways littered with refuse from a heady night before. A few dim figures hurried past to attend the local service. "Does my faith put you off?" Belknap asked.
"Put me off what, Doctor?" she asked.
He blushed as he realized what he'd said. "I meant, as a patient, you might be uncomfortable with me talking about my belief while I treat you. Some do, and I try not to. I know I should just be a medicae, not an evangelist. There are others who should minister to the health of the spirit."
"It doesn't bother me," she said.
"But I almost insisted you attended temple."
"And that seems to have paid off," she grinned.
He scowled, but he wasn't offended.
That's not quite what I meant. I was never a particularly religious man in my younger days, but on active service and working here, the things I've seen, I...
Patrick.
He shook his head. Sorry. Gara, there's darkness everywhere, it seems to me. In this proud, almighty galaxy of ours, there's only war and corruption and infamy. I can't make sense of it. Unless I believe. Believe absolutely in the pure condition of mankind. It's the only thing that keeps me sane. And I truly believe that the quality and purpose of your remaining lifespan will improve if you embrace the love of the God Emperor. I do embrace it, Patrick. Just not the way you do. Doctor, are you trying to save me?
He smiled. I think I am. In every meaning of that word.
Then thank you. But you will forgive me if I do this my way. In the time I have left, there are many things I'd like to embrace.
There was a quizzical look on his face. She stepped closer.
Like what?
He asked, his voice tight. Kara reached up on tiptoe and kissed his mouth. The kiss lingered for a few delicious moments. Then he pulled away.
Don't.
Why not?
She whispered.
Because. Because I want you to. Because I want to touch you.
You've touched me already.
Yes. As your physician. That's not what I meant.
Belknap smiled and looked down. He cleared his throat.
I can't, Kara. Because I know that if I start to touch you, I won't be able to stop.
He buttoned up his coat and walked to the door.
I'll be back in an hour, he said.
Patrick?
Yes?
Would you say a grace for my friend Zeph?
Of course.
Belknap went out and closed the door behind him.
Mademoiselle Swell?
Kara looked round. Plighton had appeared behind her.
Are you all right?
Plighton asked. Kara wiped her eyes.
Yeah, I'm fine.
Good.
The Inquisitor's calling for us.
Chapter 5 Plighton coughed, awkward.
I don't know how these things are done. I mean, in the Inquisition.
So do it your way, Junior Marshal, I said. She nodded and coughed again.
The morning before that ruckus at the Diplomatic Palace, I was called to the old sacristy adjoining the Grand Templum in A.
There's restoration work underway there, and one of the limners had found something.
Something?
Blyton clenched her teeth and sucked in a breath.
Yes. He'd found a false ceiling. The building's very old, one of the hive's first edifices. Its original ceiling had been architecturally boxed in and hidden.
The fabric of temples is altered all the time, Carl said, sipping one of the polystyle cups of hot caffeine Nail had brought in from a street kettle stand.
Sure, said Plighton, but this had been deliberately concealed. Anyway, that doesn't matter. The limner brought it to the attention of the supervising cleric, an Archdeacon Owlsman, and upon inspecting the revealed roof, the Archdeacon either committed suicide or was murdered by person or persons unknown.
This limner's got to be high on the suspect sheet, Nail said.
Plighton nodded at that.
Of course, sir. But he insisted it was suicide, and it looked like suicide to me.
I like her, Nail said, looking over at me. She called me sir. Did you hear her call me sir?
Oh, shut up, you obnoxious grunt, Carl said.
Why did you think it looked like suicide, Junior Marshal? I asked.
Because I've seen plenty of them, Inquisitor. But that is still not the point. I went up there, took some pics, looked around.
What did you see? Kiss asked.
Not much, ma'am,
Plighton replied.
I was just looking through a hole in the plasterwork with a hand light. It was very dark, but I saw enough to know there was a spectacular ceiling up there. Very, very old, ornate, beautiful. There were golden figures, inset precious stones, a chart of some sort. There was a landscape, too, rolling hills and woodland, temples. The figures all had halos.
A lovely golden place, like a landscape,
I played back my chair's fox record.
Green hills, woods, a glade, all these beautiful people walking around with halos of light around them. There were some buildings, too. I think they were golden.
Was that Zale's voice?
Kiss asked.
Yes, the other night, when he told me his vision of Kara and the sacristy.
But I never got to see that,
Kara said. I don't think that matters, I said. I think Zale was conflating details. He's not trained. Carl snorted, as if to suggest that wasn't ever going to happen now. Continue, please, Junior Marshal, I said. I took some pics, like I said. Used them as the basis of my report. The next day, I found that the case had been erased from my database and reassigned to another division. Shortly after that, my entire department was suspended by interior cases. There was some suspicion that Special Crime had made a procedural mishandling of the Sacristy case, and furthermore, there was a link to the attempt on the Chief Provost's life. We were stood down and sent home, to await interview.
Your entire department? Carl asked.
Yes, she shrugged. And then what? I asked.
I was sure something was wrong. I contacted a colleague. His name was Limwall. I couldn't reach my superior. In fact, I haven't been able to ever since. I believe he's dead.
Limwall and I tried to piece things together. We knew that the sacristy was the key. Then... Plighton paused and glanced away for a second.
Excuse me. This is hard to talk about.
Then the killers came for me, and they missed her, Kara said, getting up and pulling Plighton against her body in a tight hug. They had her address. They murdered her uncle and his nurse. Maud did manage to slay one of the killers. From what Patience has told us, I think they were using the Sheenbirds as a murder weapon.
Thrawn, screw that, Kiss muttered. I never want to see those things again.
Like Jenny X, Nail said. What? I said. On our first visit here, Nail said, a black marketeer Zale found for me. The same spec. Looked like the birds are our enemy's weapon of choice when it comes to keeping things secret. I rolled my chair forward to face Plighton. Are you all right to continue? She nodded and smiled at Kara as she broke the embrace.
Limwall and I decided to go to the old sacristy, to scope around and take some more pics. Everything I'd shot at the scene of crime on the first day had been erased. So we went in last night. To our dismay, the place was as tight as a drum. They were building something in there.
Who were? Carl asked.
Plighton shook her head.
Who knows? Ministry, I'm pretty sure.
Agents of the Ministry of Subsect Trade. They run this city, as you may have noticed. As soon as we realized we weren't getting in, Limwall and I tried to get out. They came for us. They killed Limwall. Just shot him. Just shot him dead.
Plighton teared up again.
That's when Maud and I ran into each other, Kara cut in. Thanks to Zale, it seems. We made our escape and came here.
Is that it? Carl said.
I don't know what use this...
No, said Plighton suddenly, glaring at Thonius. There's more. Limwall managed to procure a file for me, before the department was shut down.
She produced the crumpled folder and spread it out on the table.
I think he dug very deep to get this. Very deep. It's original street plans for the first phase of the hive's construction. Template records made by the pioneer builders and stored by the Skolam Architectus. The records of the city's original planner, a man named Theodore Kaditsky.
Say that name again, Carl said.
Kaditsky, Plighton repeated.
Why? Do you know him?
If it's the same man I think it is, yes, Carl said. He got to his feet and began to pace.
Golden Throne, I didn't think any of his structures were still standing.
Carl? Sir, Kaditsky was an imperial senior prominent in the pioneer expansion that originally settled this region. He was a chief administratum advisor to the Lord Rufus Helican, Lord Baring Angelus, and Lord Frederick Antimar, and you know where those names ended up. He was an architect, a city planner, a deviser, who believed, and this is evident in his writings, that the hive cities of mankind should follow a pattern that, in his words, must follow the gracious schemes of heaven.
You've read this material? Nail asked.
Of course.
The stuff you know, Kiss smiled.
Thonius bowed to her, mockingly.
Go on, Carl, I prompted.
He turned to face me. Inquisitor, Kaditsky was a genius, ahead of his time. He planned buildings that were designed to resonate with the warp. He constructed towers that channeled the Astronomicon, thanks only to their architectural structures. And, as it turned out, he was a madman. The Ordos penanced him and later executed him, as an enemy of the throne. All of his known works were demolished and leveled. Carl turned to the table and began to sort through the papers spilling out of Pleiten's folder.
And now we find...
He swallowed hard, agitated.
And now it turns out this entire hive was constructed on plans he drew.
Which means what, Carl? I said. He stared at me.
Give me time to process these charts. I'll be able to tell better then. But on the face of it, I'd say Petropolis isn't a city. It isn't a hive.
Cutting you more slack than you deserve, Thonius, Nail said, leaning forward. What, on the face of it, are we talking about?
Carl glared at Nail.
Damn you, bitch. That tone of yours is getting on my nerves. Why don't you trust my learning just for once?
The question stands, Carl, Frauke said quietly, rising to his feet from the chair in the back of the room. What are we talking about? Carl spread the papers out wide. Petropolis has grown, developed, overlapped itself, but its basic structure remains. You can see the axes. Ignore the distortion of more recent expansion. Here, see? And here, the plan remains just as Kaczynski arranged it in the original proposal of construction. There's a symmetry, an order, underlying every part of Petropolis that has been added since. An occult geography. Look, said Pleiten, clearly unsure if she was supposed to butt in at this point, but admirably positive she should.
If Petropolis isn't a city, if it isn't a hive, as you said, what is it? What was it built for? What did Kaczynski plan here?
An instrument, Carl replied.
A device. A spiritual resonator that would only begin to operate when it was filled with millions and millions of human beings.
Holy throne!
Everyone looked at me. Kara, Nail, Kiss, Frauke, Thonius, and Pleiten. I realized I had been the one who had exclaimed.
Chapter 6. The immense sevenfold vault hatch opened slowly, like the petals of a flower blossoming. Yeda Trice and Taurus Revoke stepped inside, into the cool, pure air, into the hemisphere of light. They could hear the powerful air scrubbers panting and gusting in the darkness above. They were entering the chamber of the lexicon, directly 3 floors down from the Encompass Room. The lexicon was a book, but it was not fashioned in the shape of any conventional book. Curving pages, printed on inert metal, were fixed to an axial spine, so that the lexicon took the form of a metal sphere, 2 handspans in diameter. A stroke of the hand would peel the sphere open on a particular page, like parting the feathers of a bird. But no hand had ever touched the lexicon. It hung in a sterile suspensor beam, each additional page fitted into it by the ring assembly of skeletal servo arms sprouting like a crown below it on the deck. Reading beams, bright violet, maintained an assessment of the pages, scanning for errors or faults, watching for imperfections, even ones as slight as a rogue mote of dust. No human had ever read the lexicon either. The primer had been compiled remotely via the servos. A very few secretists and cipherists had viewed individual pages, even studied particular sequences, but no one had regarded the plenary contents. No one had that much sanity or willpower. Yet. Trice gazed at the layered metal globe suspended in the column of light. The chamber servitors approached him, shambling beetle things painted surgical white or scrubbed to base metal, their hulls covered with purity seals. "Is everything ready for conveyance?" Trice asked. One of the servitors projected a hololithic reply, a moving diagram that showed how the entire west wall of the chamber would hinge away so that the lexicon could be carried, by means of manipulation beams, into the hold cavity of a specially refitted bulk lifter. Trice nodded, flicking his hands through the hololithic image to advance it. He flicked back to check several details.
"The lifter pilot?"
"A surgically lobotomized operator, as you specified," said Revoke. "General flight governance will come remotely from palace control."
"Who have you put on that?"
"Galbraid," Revoke said. "The best pilot we have."
"It's quite beautiful,
don't you think?"
Trice said, gazing at the lexicon.
"Yes," said Revoke. "I think it is."
Trice turned suddenly, hearing voices from above. He stared up at the observation gallery that ran around the chamber. High up.
Revoke followed his gaze.
"What is he doing here?"
Trice demanded. The Diadochoi was wearing his public face. Kalzean was with him, looking down at the lexicon as he listened to the Diadochoi talk. They were too far away for the words to be distinct, but the Diadochoi was evidently explaining the principles in detail. Trice took a few angry steps towards the nearest staircase, but Revoke stopped him.
"Go up there and do what?"
he said quietly. Trice's eyes shone with bitterness, but he made no reply. Revoke said, "You have enough things to do today without finding time for recriminations and arguments. Let it go."
"He is so contrary, so willful. He shows me no respect."
"Sir, you were the instigator and master of this project from the start, but nevertheless you allowed him to become part of it. You could have refused the partnership with him. I believe you didn't because you are afraid of him." Trice nodded slightly, his lips pursed. "He is the most dangerous man I have ever met. Once our paths had crossed, there was no way I could disentangle myself from him. It was better to exploit his talents and tolerate his faults."
"Then you should continue to do so."
Trice nodded again, more emphatically now, and the two men started to walk back to the vault hatch. "Remember," Revoke said quietly, "you made him. You made him part of this great project. You made him Lord Governor Subsector. You made him Diadochoi, and tonight you will make him a god. The one thing you don't want to make him is your enemy." Patience's kiss made a revolted sound.
"Did you have to bring that thing in here?"
Nail nodded. He had caught and killed a small sheen bird on the roof, and now was stripping it apart, using some tools and cutters he'd borrowed from Belknap. Metal feathers and dismantled chrome mechanisms lay on the white cloth Nail had spread out on one of the smaller tables.
"I figure we need to know how these things work."
Close up. Dead. It was a miserable thing. Age and weather had worn it down to a silver wire skeleton, with stiletto blade plumes and a secateur beak. Deposits of thick black filth and grease had built up in its crevices and contours, and it stank of pollution.
"Carl told me the sheen birds of Petropolis had been commissioned from the Guild Mechanicus by the city founders. Machine birds, you see. They were meant to be part of the architecture, programmed to simulate the flocking activities of real bird life, a mobile decoration to complement the city spires."
Nail grunted.
"The stuff he knows."
"After my encounter with them, I don't think of them as decoration any more,"
Kiss said.
"And it all takes on a more sinister quality now we all know about Kaditsky. I mean, they were probably his idea, along with all the other hidden meanings and esoteric structures he laced into this city."
"Well, they're hard to kill," Nail said. "Look here." He took a stainless steel probe and levered open the sheen bird's thorax, exposing the core of the mechanism.
"I mean, they'll break if you hit them hard enough. But the power source, it's a solar charging unit, and the miniature cogitation box is incredibly well protected. Meant to last forever, after all."
"How did you kill it?" Kiss asked.
"I netted it, and then hit it hard enough. The point is, it was one single small feral sheen bird, roosting up near the heating flues. It was not part of a flock, under control, or trying to kill me."
Patience thought about that ruefully. It was late morning, the day a clear, muzzy gray. There was an oddly muted sense of expectation in the air, but Kiss was pretty sure she was projecting that herself. Carl, the Marshal Woman Plighton, and the Inquisitor himself were grouped around Belknap's old, underpowered cogitator at the far end of the lockup, trying to discern some comprehensible pattern from the ancient and incomplete designs of the mad architect Theodore Kaditsky. Nearby, close to where Nail and Kiss sat, Frauke was reclining on a stack of old mattresses, reading his slates and smoking non-stop. Zale lay on the little cot beside him. There had been no change in the boy's condition. Belknap was off running his morning surgery. In the lockup's adjoining room, Kara was sorting through the weapons and equipment Carl and Frauke had managed to salvage from Miseramus before their hasty exit. It wasn't much, though Patience was happy at least that her quiver of spare kindblades had been amongst it. Unworth was helping Kara. On several occasions, Kiss had overheard Ravenna suggest to Unworth
that he should slip away, return to his ship, and extract himself from the danger. Unworth had refused. In fact, he had
obtusely strenuated the supposition.
Kiss was glad. When the time came, they would need all the help they could get, and Unworth had revealed himself to be a man of hidden talents. His loyalty, his endurance, and his piloting skills being the three most notable revelations so far. And Kiss hoped that somewhere down the line, Unworth might claim a degree of payback against the men who had tortured and brutalized him. Kiss considered taking a walk, just a few blocks, until she was clear of Frauke's blunting, so she could test how well her telekinesis had returned. But suddenly, there was no time. "You'd better all see this," Ravenna said. Nail called Kara and Unworth in from the side room, and the group gathered in around Belknap's cogitator. "We're pretty much certain now," Carl began, "that the old sacristy is of particular importance because it is the point at which the axes cross. It's what Kaditsky called the true center, the fulcrum on which his entire design turns. If Petropolis is a temple, then the old sacristy is the high altar." "So whatever they're planning to do," said Kara, "they'll do it there."
"Yes," Ravenna said. "Now tell them the rest, Carl."
"Well, I started to run some basic searches and data probes about the old sacristy, and ran into stuff. There's something going on. The Grand Templum is closed today, no reason given, and the immediate area has been sealed. We've got lots of irregular activity at the Ministry, the Governor's Palace, and the Magistratum. Comm lines are very busy. Security's been heightened at state buildings. Road networks are closed in Formal A. Some public data systems have been suspended. Airspace above A has been restricted. What else?"
"It's happening now, today, tomorrow at the latest," Ravenna said, and though his transponded voice was flat and toneless, Kiss's spine prickled. "So we don't have time to call for help, and we don't have time to devise a sophisticated plan to combat this. We have to go in right now and do whatever we can."
"Ah," said Nail, "the old-fashioned way. Let's load up."
I watched them prepare, selecting armor and weapons from the limited resources we had left. They were all eager, ready, and although we had no real plan and we were outgunned to an almost comical degree, positive action felt so much better than hiding and waiting. Plighton came to speak with me. "Request permission to join your people on this, Inquisitor," she said.
"Granted, Junior Marshal. I hadn't expected you to sit this one out anyway. May I call you Maud?"
"Of course, Inquisitor."
"Ravenna will do. Get what you need from Nail, Maud, and may the Emperor protect you." I had prepared a report, storing the document in my chair's memory, and now I made some final alterations to bring the facts up to date, and transferred it to a message tile.
"Kara."
"Yes, Gideon."
"Take this, if you will, to the nearest clerk of law or legal practice. Belknap will know of one. Arrange for a clerk or lawyer to leave Petropolis at once with this tile, and travel to the nearest conurbation with an astro-telepathic office. He will then have the contents of this pod sent immediately to the Ordos on Thracian Primaris. I've attached all the necessary codes. You'll have to pay him well, so access our funds and use your discretion. I don't really care what it costs."
Kara picked up the little tile.
"I'll get right on it," she said.
I moved across the chamber and stopped beside Sholto Unworth.
"Master Unworth, I know I am just wasting words, but you do not have to involve yourself in this." He looked at me and grinned.
"I would be preferential to muck in and do some good. Unlike the name my old father straddled me with, I would like to be remembered as a man who had some worth."
"So be it. Please follow all the instructions my people give you. They are experts in what we are about to do."
"Which is?"
Unworth cocked his head. "Walk headlong into death, destruction, and all points in between."
I left him laughing at that and approached Frauke in the corner of the room.
"You won't be coming in with us, Whiston."
"Oh," he said. "Why?"
he added after a moment. "Because I need someone to stay here with Zael. I need someone who can watch over him."
"Surely the Medicae."
"I need someone who knows enough about what's at stake to know what to do if he wakes before I return, or what to do if I don't return."
He frowned and nodded.
"I see.
Well, you certainly can't be asking the Medicae that."
"If Zael is what we fear he is, you have the greatest immunity. It might be enough for you to get done anything that needs to be done. before it's too late.
Very well.
Whiston, as far as I'm concerned, he's still Zale. He's still an innocent teenage boy, and he still deserves our protection. The moment you get a hint he's anything other than that, act. And if I don't come back, you won't have a choice. The risk would be too great.
I understand, said Whiston Frauke.
I need to find the nearest reliable law office, Kara began as she walked into the surgery. Maybe even a bail bonder or a notary, or...
What are you doing?
Belknap was sorting medical instruments and dressing packs into his black leather practice bag.
Getting ready, he said.
For what? Nail told me what was going on. He wanted to borrow some field dressings and wound kits. Well, if you're going into a situation that you know is going to be violent, I think you need a trained combat medicae with you.
Oh, no,
Kara began. It's not up for debate, Belknap said. What happens if me being there to patch one of you up and get you back on your feet is the difference between success or failure today? I don't even want to think about how much is at stake.
Kara sighed.
Belknap opened a metal footlocker and took out an object wrapped in an oilcloth. Besides, he went on, it's a bonus if that Medicaid knows how to shoot. An old, well-worn las carbine came out of the cloth. It was guard issue and had a folded skeleton stock. Belknap looked it over with practiced skill, then dropped it into his bag.
This is all because I kissed you, isn't it? Kara said.
Yeah, smiled Belknap. Probably is. Later in the afternoon, a few spits of rain in the air, Belknap opened the metal shutters of his lockup's loading bay, and the Bergman rumbled out onto the sink street, followed by the Cargo 8. Belknap closed and locked the shutters, and then climbed into the Cargo 8. A moment later, the two vehicles pulled away and joined the upstack traffic. From the grubby window of the lockup, Frauke watched them leave.
Just you and me now, he said.
Frauke took out his handgun, checked the load, set it on the table beside him, and sat down next to Zale's cot.
Chapter 7
It's time, sir, said Revoke. The sixth hour. Trice knew that. He had just changed into the long grey robes prepared for the ritual, and in doing so had removed his pocket cron for the last time.
How do I look?
Regal, said Revoke. But we should be leaving now. Side by side, they left the state apartments and strode down the long hallway.
Reports?
Trice asked as they walked.
The Diadochoi and the ritual cipherists are already en route to the sacristy. The anonymic wafers have been sent out to the axial temples. Our people there report capacity congregations for the evening masses. City media networks have been switched to our control, and selective broadcast will begin shortly. Astropathic function for the entire hive is also secured and shut down. Situation says the crisis we stage-managed in Carbonopolis is monopolizing global attention, as we hoped. The perfecti of the geometricians confirms that the Encompass Room is aligned and composed. They reached the secure elevators. The duty guards bowed as they stood back to admit the chief provost.
Any problems? Trice continued. With a low warble, the elevator began to carry them up through the palace.
Some crowd issues in Formal A, Revoke said. Nothing serious, but a lot of people gathering. Some are worried about the terrorism reports from the Second City and just want to get into the Grand Templum to pray. But a lot more are there out of curiosity. We've closed the area down, but it's obvious from a distance that something big's going on.
How do we handle that?
I've already spoken to Sankles, Revoke said. He's moving every available marshal from interior cases into the cordon zone to supplement the secretists. Sankles has assured me he's mobilized full crowd control and riot gear.
All right, that's good.
Anything else? Revoke shook his head. The elevator came to a stop, and the doors slid back to let them out onto the concourse of one of the small cap-level landing bays. A luxurious armored flyer with the crest of the ministry on its stubby wings sat on the pad, engines idling. Two gunship escorts sat behind it. Guards snapped to attention. The side hatch of the flyer stood open, and the chief provost hurried to it, Revoke with him. They climbed into the passenger bay, and an aide closed the hatch.
Conveyance of the lexicon will begin in 15 minutes, Revoke said.
Then we go to condition beta, Trice replied. The flyer rose into the air and powered out of the landing bay with the gunships flanking it.
It was already getting dark, and the immense city below spread out in a mass of gloomy monoliths and glittering lights. We were still streets away, but already it was clear that the precincts of the Grand Templum were the scene of some important event this night. A bright glow of searchlights lit up the sky beyond the nearby buildings, and crowds of pedestrians were beginning to clot the approach roads. Overhead, flyers and gunships buzzed past with increasing frequency, some obviously patrolling the district. "It's getting sticky," Carl voxed. He was up ahead of me, riding in the Bergman with Kara and Maud Pleiten. "Lot of crowd build-up and a palpable sense of unease, almost panic. We can see cordons now. Yeah, riot cordons. Armed marshals. Roadblocks, too. They're checking all traffic. Nothing's getting within a kilometre of the Templum precinct, except magistratum vehicles."
"Understood," I said. I consulted my chair's filed charts of the Templum area. "Any suggestions?"
"Pleiten says she and her pal got in last night by way of the northwest corner. It's a jumble of buildings, almshouses, and beneficent chapels and the like."
"I see it on my chart."
"The three of us might be able to slip in that way. I'd like to give it a try."
"All right," I replied. "But be careful and stay in contact." Up ahead, through the front screen of the Cargo 8's cab, we saw the Bergman pull off through the crowds down a side street and disappear.
"What about us, then?"
Nail asked from the wheel. "We try the front way," I said.
"Just walk in,"
Kiss asked, dubiously.
"Well, I could make everyone in the crowd and every marshal on that cordon line think we were a magistratum truck full of riot officers, but I don't want to play the psychic card too early and get us picked up."
"If you can't make us look like a magistratum truck, why don't we just use a magistratum truck?"
Belknap asked.
"I like the way he thinks," Nail said.
It took nearly 25 minutes to navigate around the back streets of the district to the northwest corner of the Templum precincts. But Carl's instinct had been good. The area was almost deserted. The crowds evidently were favoring the more public zones, like the wide boulevards leading into Templum Square. Pleiten drove the purring Bergman into a cobbled lane that ran down the back of the Choristers' Hall and pulled into a small yard. The old precinct buildings around them were deserted and dark, though beyond them, in the southeast, the night sky was glowing with the powerful illumination set up around the Templum. The three of them got out and checked their equipment one final time. Pleiten was wearing her black magistratum body armor with the badges and insignia of special crime removed, and, apart from her holstered Transvasa 9, she carried a big black pump-action riot gun that Nail had found for her. Pleiten seemed a big, bulky figure compared to the much shorter, curvier Kara, whose compact body was wrapped in a dark purple armored body glove with a short tan jacket over the top. She carried the shivered sword across her back and a bolt pistol in her hands.
"Which way?"
Kara whispered.
"Follow the light," Carl said, snidely.
"We can do that," Pleiten said, "but if we jink over to the left there, we can come in along the side of the pauper's school and then be screened by the almshouse wall all the way down to the refectory and the gate lodge."
"The stuff you know,"
Carl mocked, checking his Hecuta, then sliding it away under the long brown leather coat he was wearing.
"What's that?"
Kara asked, pointing at the tails of his coat. Carl opened the leather coat and drew the sheathed blade out.
"Throne, where did you get that?"
"It's one of the rhyming swords that Incunabula used to kill Mathuin," Carl replied. "I found it in the rubble just before we left. I intend to shove it right back down the throat of whoever sent that thing." With Pleiten leading, they scurried down the gloomy lane, and across into a paved courtyard lit by a single lamp. On the far side, it opened up into the circuit road that ran around the inner precinct proper. A magistratum riot crawler rumbled past along the circuit road.
"Anyone around?"
Kara whispered.
"Yeah, there's a 3-man patrol down there,"
Pleiten replied.
"Give it a sec." "Yeah, they've gone round the corner. Go."
The three of them dashed across the circuit road, ducked under the luminous white cordon and into a small, unlit cobbled lane with the bulk of the pauper's school to their right. They hurried on, keeping their backs to the wall. Kara signaled them to freeze as a 6-man squad of riot officers in full armor jogged past the end of the lane. Then she beckoned them on again. Carl brought up the rear. He looked around and sniffed the cold night air.
"It's going to be a wild night," he muttered.
a large black magistratum truck came grumbling down the empty transit underway, and Belknap stepped out from behind the cargo 8, waving his hands. The truck came to a halt, engine running, and a marshal, looking huge in his riot armor, clambered down.
"What's the problem?"
he crackled over his helmet vox.
"My 8's broken down. I was told to clear out of the area just now by some of you boys, and then the damn thing stalled on me. Can you give me a hand? I'm no good with engines."
The marshal signaled to his driver and followed Belknap around the cargo 8 to the open engine hatch.
"Surprise!" said Nail, and shot him through the visor.
At the same moment, a kine blade whistled out and pinned the truck's driver to his seat back. "Clear!" called Kiss. Unworth jumped down from the tailgate of the cargo 8 and opened the back hatch of the magistratum vehicle for me. Belknap, Nail, and Kiss dumped the bodies of the marshals in our vehicle and locked it up. Then Belknap and Kiss joined Unworth and myself in the back of the magistratum truck, and Nail got in behind the wheel. He put the big machine in gear and drove us away along the transit, turned right into one of the boulevards, and began to crawl through the pedestrian crowds gathering at the cordon across the mouth of Templum Square. There were two similar magistratum trucks and a riot crawler in line ahead of us, and the marshals at the cordon had lifted the barriers aside to bring them through.
"If anybody wants to pray for good fortune, they should do it now," Nail said as we closed on the barrier.
To my surprise, Belknap actually did what Nail suggested, closing his eyes and mouthing the charm of sanctity under his breath. Through the armored hull of the truck, we could hear the anxious murmurings of the vast crowd.
"Nearly there," Nail said.
Eager to get the cordon closed and prevent the pressing crowd from spilling through, the marshals waved us on after the other vehicles. We were in the huge plaza of Temple Square now. It seemed ominously empty after the bustle of the streets. The bulk of the Grand Templum towered ahead of us, lit up by dozens of powerful searchlight units that had been erected around the plaza. The huge white stab beams lanced up into the night sky and tracked slowly, occasionally catching on the fuselage of one of the patrol flyers circling low over the area. There were a lot of riot marshals on the ground around the Templum, along with figures in grey suits. I noted that at least three of these grey figures were managing weapon servitors on leashes. Marshals with lighted batons were ushering us over to park with other magistratum trucks in the plaza on the east side of the Templum. There were dozens of vehicles drawn up there already. Nail pulled us in on the far side of them, so line of sight from the main activity around the front entrance to us was blocked by the parked trucks.
"What's the time?" Kiss asked.
"Nearly 7:30," I replied.
Yeda Trice climbed out of his flyer and walked clear, keeping his head low as it rose away again into the searchlit sky. Revoke led the Chief Provost in through the main entrance of the Grand Templum, and the secretists and marshals all around them broke into spontaneous applause.
"Thank you," smiled Trice. "Thank you all."
Bonehart awaited them in the immense nave.
"Everything is secure. All units report steady status. Condition beta."
"Excellent," Trice said, straightening his robes.
"The lexicon is 2 minutes away," Bonehart added.
"I want to see it arrive," Trice said. "Where's the Diadochoi?"
"Already in the sacristy," Bonehart replied. "He went through as soon as he touched down, along with the cipherists."
"And Calzean?"
"Calzean was with him, sir."
Trice turned to Revoke. "I'd like you to come with me, Taurus. After all your work, you should witness this too."
"I should stay and supervise," Revoke began.
"Everything's covered," Bonehart said. "You go on."
Revoke nodded to Bonehart and followed the Chief Provost out through the west entrance and along the wide exterior cloister to the old sacristy. This building, too, was floodlit, the vertical searchlight beams like the bars of a giant cage around it.
"Day of days," Trice murmured.
"This is a great moment for you, sir," Revoke replied. "A culmination."
"A great moment for us all," Trice said. They entered the old sacristy. The vault was lit by thousands of glow globes. Ministry contractors had erected the large circular dais under the domed roof, the center of the dais positioned directly beneath the apex of the dome. Ranks of seating had been built into the edges of the dais, facing inwards, and, at the compass points, sleek obelisks of resonant stone had been set upright in sockets, each one corresponding exactly to the axes of the hive's occult geometry. Trice climbed up the short flight of steps onto the dais, seeing Calzean and his bodyguard sitting amongst the other senior cipherists and dignitaries in the seating section.
Calzean nodded to Trice, but Trice chose to ignore him. The air was clean and cold. The central area of the wide dais was empty, except for the hub of suspensor rods poking up through the precise center of the stage. Around this hub stood 13 grey-robed cypherists, chosen to officiate the annunciation. The Diadochoi was with them.
"What is he wearing?"
Trice hissed to Revoke. The Diadochoi was not dressed in the grey ritual robes Trice had so carefully designed and made. He was wearing a tailored gown of scarlet velvet and a long, shrouding mantle.
"Lord,"
Trice said, approaching the Diadochoi. The Diadochoi turned and smiled at Trice. He was using his public face, the face of Oscar Ludolf Barazan.
"Yeda, our great day reaches its climax. Aren't you excited?"
"Lord, you should be changed by now. The ritual robes."
"Too drab for an occasion like tonight. I will be wearing this."
"Not drab, Lord." Trice fought to contain his fury. "I designed the robes to be inert, so that they would not, by color or design or pattern, threaten the purity of—"
"You worry too much, Yeda,"
the Diadochoi said.
"Hush up now. See, the lexicon is here."
Trice was about to explode with rage, but Revoke squeezed his arm and shook his head. Everyone looked up. The ages-old false ceiling of the sacristy roof, accidentally penetrated by a simple limner, had been torn out. The real roof, the original dome, was now revealed. The sheer beauty of the ancient frescoes, the haloed figures, the golden temples, the idyllic pastoral landscape, stilled Trice's anger for a moment. Perfection unveiled. Paradise found. This, Trice considered, was what had driven Archdeacon Alsman to suicide. The sheer heresy of it. For all its ornamentation, for all its lapis and selpic, its silver-etched constellations, this was Theodore Kaditsky's handiwork. There was no god-emperor, no primarchs, no illustrious holies of the imperial creed. What the frescoes showed, and boldly proclaimed in their inscriptions, was a prelapsarian Eden, where ordinary men and women walked upon the face of Terra and were bestowed with the power of gods. Around them were the esoteric marks of a great chart, a mirror of the scribings the geometricians had wrought upon the floor of the Encompass Room. The perfect axial alignment of the hive's mechanism, the occult order and the lines of power that Kaditsky had built into his Petropolis. "Lexicon conveyance approaching," Revoke said, as his headset bipped.
"Open the shutter," said the Diadochoi.
With a whir, the central portion of the dome, high above them, slid open, leaves of metal unfolding around each other. They could hear the jet wash of a lifter hovering over the roof. "Time?" Trice asked.
10 minutes to 8, sir."
"We are at condition Alpha," said Trice. Kara, Plighton, and Carl had reached the northeast gate lodge of the Templum precinct. The old sacristy was ahead of them now, swathed in light.
"Cover!"
Carl hissed. They ducked into the shadows as the roar of an approaching lifter echoed around the old walls.
"Gods!"
said Plighton, peering out. Blazing with stab lights, a heavy lifter was coming in over the domed roof of the old sacristy, caught in the beams of the flood lamps. It hovered in place, the noise of its engines shrill, and projected an intense white beam down from its belly, apparently into the top of the dome.
"Ravenna! Ravenna!"
Carl Vox anxiously.
"It's started. Something big is happening."
On the east side of the Grand Templum, we got out of the Magistratum truck. There was no longer any time to worry about the risks of discovery. I slid my chair up around the outer wall of the Templum, heading for the main entrance. Belknap and Nail followed me, running. Nail, a huge shape in his brown armored body glove, held a custom plasma rifle up to his chest. He'd fitted it with an underbarrel grenade launcher. Belknap, leaner than Nail, in his black army fatigues and long, billowing leather coat, cut a romantic figure like a pirate or a swashbuckler. He carried his practice bag in his left hand. Kiss and Unworth went the other way, looping around the north side of the Templum. Dressed in a tight green skin suit, her hair loose, Kiss was forced to rein in her long stride so that the diminutive Unworth could keep up. Patience had a twinned pair of las pistols, and she'd drawn them. Her four kind blades remained sheathed in the boning of her bodice.
"Keep up, Sholto,"
In all affectation, I am racing as fast as my foreshortened underlimbs can go. I am not provided with lissom luggage such as you display, mademoiselle.
Lissom luggage, Patience said. Did you just compliment me, Sholto?
I believe something of that formature may have slid out.
Suddenly, there were shapes ahead of them. Figures, riot marshals, and at least two secretists in grey. Kiss didn't hesitate. Running towards them, she began firing her las pistols.
Unworth, let's go. We're in it now.
And so we begin,
Nail said lightly, as the mass of marshals and secretists covering the main entrance of the Grand Templum spotted us. No more hiding. Fire at will, Harlan. Let's see how many we can take with us. Massing forward, the agents of our enemy had begun bellowing challenges, but at least one of them clearly knew an armored support chair was a warning sign. They began firing. Riot guns boomed in the mailed fists of interior cases officers, and the las guns and pistols of the secretists quickly joined them. Get down, I transponded, and began to let rip with my psi cannon. My shots ripped through the front rank of riot marshals at a distance of 25 meters, bursting their armor and sending them sprawling. I did not slow my pace. Shots struck my chair's front and bounced off. Belknap had sensibly ducked in behind me, using my chair as a shield. Nail to the left of me hit the deck, rolled and came up on his knees as gunfire ripped over him and pummeled the sides of the Magistratum transporters parked behind us. He began to fire, raking with his plasma rifle, simultaneously pumping grenades from the underbarrel launcher. Mayhem swept across the Templum Square in front of the great church. A ferocious ripple of explosions from Nail's launcher raised fireballs across the broken flagstones and up the entrance steps, sending bodies flailing into the air. His plasma bolts licked like daggers of sunlight, blowing men apart or ripping through them. Sirens began to sound. Pausing only to reload his launcher from the pack on his hip, Nail was up again, running and firing. Boiling smoke now swathed the main entrance. The air was full of gunfire and confused yelling. I skimmed forward over tangled, crumpled bodies. Carl! I voxed. There was no answer. Somewhere off to my left, Nail was exchanging a furious barrage of shots with the wrong-footed enemy. I heard the bang of shotguns, the crack of las weapons, a melody syncopated by the fierce, squealing shriek of his plasma rifle. Straight ahead of me, two weapon servitors bounded out of the thick, black smoke raised by Nail's munitions. They were huge, chromed canhounds, unslipped, and ready to kill. Their pink recognition beams found my bulky shape at once. Belknap, down! The medique ducked behind my chair, not so much because I had told him to, but because I had layered my will into the telepathic burst, forcing him to drop. The gun pods on the servitors' backs began to fire, drizzling me with murderous fire from their four las rifles. Fortunately, the adepts of the Guild Mechanicus, who had manufactured my support chair at Gregor Eisenhorn's personal request, had made it with the same care they used for mainline battle tanks and striding war titans. The devastating onslaught spattered off my housing like rain. The cannon hounds hesitated, bemused. I knew my chair would not easily withstand a second full-on salvo. I reached out with my psi and lifted one of the hounds off its feet, activating its gun pods as I swung it round to face its companion. Crippled by the first blizzard of las bolts, the other hound instinctively returned fire, and the two weapon servitors destroyed each other in a searing exchange of close-range shots. I let the ruined servitor go, and it crashed to the ground, parts of its mechanism spilling out and scattering across the flagstones. Its companion had been fused into a crater by the ferocity of fire. I moved forward again. A secretist I had not seen came out of the whirling smoke to my left, aiming a long las. Behind me, Belknap raised his las carbine out of his practice bag and shot the man three times through the torso, slamming him onto his back. Thank you, I said, but I could have covered it. Just trying to be useful, Belknap replied. The suspensor beam shafted in through the open shutter, and the lexicon, a tiny, dark sphere, descended into the old sacristy. The suspensor rods below in the middle of the dais crackled as they activated and took the weight of it, lowering it gently until it sat at waist height in the middle of the chamber. The beam from above snapped off, and the lifter pulled away. The shutter gradually began to lock back in place. The Diadochoi stepped towards the slowly revolving lexicon held in the beam of light. The 13 cipherists closed around him.
"The first enunciation will now begin," the Diadochoi said.
Yeda, take your seat.
Trice nodded humbly and backed away towards the seating. Time? He asked. 8:02, replied Revoke. Send the signal to the Axial Temples. Tell the clerics to begin enunciating the anonymic wafers. Signal is sent, Revoke replied. Trice sat down in the front row of the dais seating. Beside him, Revoke took a seat, and then immediately got to his feet again, his hand to his forehead.
Taurus?
An alert, sir. Trouble at the main entrance of the Templum. And...
What?
Trice hissed. Unleashed psychic power. Very strong, very urgent. I can taste him. It's Ravenna. Trice went pale.
Go, he breathed. Go now, and kill him for damnation's sake.
Revoke hurried down off the dais, out of the sacristy, and began to sprint down the cloister towards the Grand Templum. Behind the Grand Templum, Kiss ceased fire. Faced by her brutal assault, the five marshals and the three secretists she had encountered had tried to fall back into cover around the north porch so they might cut her down while she was still in the open. But she had nudged out with her telekinesis and frozen them all in their tracks. Startled, immobile targets. The yard was now littered with their bodies. Kiss looked back at Unworth. The barrel of the machine pistol he had tied to his hands was smoking. He had not hesitated when the shooting began.
Nice work, she said. I try my part, as it goes.
Ahead of them, around the curve of the Grand Templum and the outcrop of the north porch, the back of the old sacristy was lit up by floodlights. Pulling away from the domed roof, a brightly lit lifter was beginning to climb up into the night sky.
I think we're missing the main event, Kiss said. Follow me.
I would, mademoiselle, excepting for that discomforting sound.
Patience Kiss came to a halt and looked around. A figure stood just inside the doorway of the north porch, urgently spinning a cyber lure around himself. High above them, a furious clinking rang out of the night, the beating of steel wings. Called out of the air from every building in the formal, the unkindness formed into a seething ball overhead, glittering and flashing in the floodlights.
Not again,
Unworth stammered.
Sholto, get behind me, said Patience Kiss. Get behind me now.
Forming themselves into a slender arrowhead, the sheen birds banked upwards, then dipped and streamed down to shred them both. Wounded in the thigh, limping, Harlan Nail swung around and cut down two more secretists with his plasma rifle. He could see the main entrance of the Grand Templum, swathed in smoke, most of which he had created. But he no longer had sight of either Ravenna or Belknap. The Templum Square looked like a battlefield, like the streets of a city where civil war had raged. The fury of his one-man gun battle with the marshals and secretists had sent panic cascading through the already jumpy crowds at the edge of the square. A full-scale riot had broken out along the approach roads and boulevards. Nail knew he had to get to the old sacristy. He limped forward, ignoring the distant echoes of gunfire and screaming, issuing from the darkness and the smoke. Then, something more solid came out of the smoke and kicked him in the face. Nail went down on his hands and knees and lost his grip on the plasma rifle. Bonehard threw a killing punch down at Nail's spine, but Nail rolled onto his back, his mouth bleeding, and captured the punch in the cup of his hands. Still on his back, he tightened his grip like a vice and fractured the hand bones and fingers in Bonehart's fist. Bonehart screamed in pain and staggered away, clutching his hand. Kicking himself back onto his feet, Nail drew his Hostec autos and pumped 8 shots through Bonehart's body. The secretist juddered and fell. A pistol in each hand, Nail circled, checking for other surprises. There was no one in sight, no one alive anyway. So why did he feel like a blade struck out of nowhere? So hard and fast, Nail had barely time to react. He lurched backwards, and the blade sliced off the muzzles of both of his weapons. He tossed the ruined guns aside and hunched in low, turning, wary. Monica, a scarcely visible phantom in the smoky air, danced around him and stabbed with her serrated blade. Nail felt the rip gouge his back, right through his armored body glove. Desperately he turned around, but the phantom had already vanished. Keeping behind the big man, always behind him, Monica closed for the kill. With Belknap behind me, I hovered into the nave of the Grand Templum. It was an empty and silent space, in shocking contrast to the violent night outside. This way, I said to Belknap. A man in a grey suit ran in through the west entrance ahead of us. He had stale yellow eyes, like dying suns. He slowed down and began to pace towards us.
"Imperial Inquisition," I announced. "Surrender now."
"I know who you are," he said. I knew who he was, too. He wrenched out with his mind and slammed me backwards. Belknap tried to shoot him, but the yellow-eyed man merely nodded and tossed the good doctor 20 meters backwards through the air. Belknap cracked a pew as he landed. He rolled onto the floor, unconscious.
"Let's go," I said, and went fleshless. Revoke met me head-on, forming a barbed red spectral form that tasted of sour wine and ripped right through my mental shields. I foundered back, as exposed as the inner flesh of a seafood delicacy broken from its shell at a supper table. Aware of the stench of my own mental wounds, I reinforced my armor and met Revoke again, lancing skewers of Psi-Force into his red mind form. They transfixed him like quills. He howled. The aftershock rattled the wooden pews of the Grand Templum and blew out several windows. I pushed the skewers deeper, becoming an urchin form laden with meter-long spines. Revoke screamed again and broke away, shattering the spines like glass. He circled into the upper limits of the Grand Templum, taking the form of something vaguely bat-winged, whose distressing shape was described by more than 4 dimensions. It extruded long, fibrous tentacles that lashed me, stripping away my perfunctory shielding and savaged the edges of my mind. In desperate defense, I made my fleshless form blade-sharp and drove upwards through the flailing tentacles, severing some, until I punctured the wet core inside the bat-shape. Shuddering, Revoke's body fell to its knees. Blood drizzled out of his eyes and nose. He tightened his mind, folding the alien bat-form up into a tiny red dot, then unfolding the dot as a complex geometric form. The shape began to self-repeat and fill the air with copies of itself at an exponential rate. The multiplying geometric forms smelled of burned blood and old bones. I tried to run, seeking space to fight back. They were all around me. There was a violent snap, which felt like the entire planet had been pulled out of gravity like a fruit being plucked off a bough. The foul geometric forms, hundreds of them now, rushed in together, fitting tightly against one another like the teeth of a fractal dragon, catching my mind between them. This was constriction like nothing I had ever known. Not biting, but crushing, being caught between complex shapes that fitted against each other so perfectly that there was no space between them for anything else to exist. I was being crushed into nothing, compressed so tightly that the only place I could go was outside reality to my doom. I tried to break free. I couldn't. I couldn't. Kara, Karl, and Pleiten rushed the north door of the old sacristy and crouched in the shadows. From their point of concealment, they could see the newly built dais and the hooded cypherists gathered around the slowly turning sphere hanging in the column of light. "We should..." Pleiten began.
"Wait!" Karl cried. "Terra's sake! That's Governor Barazan!"
The Diadochoi reached his hands into the light and opened the metal leaves of the lexicon. He began to read, announcing the unannounceable. Plaster fell from the ceiling. Lightning flared in the sky above. The Diadochoi enunciated the first few syllables of creation. Fed with power, the resonating obelisks began to shine. With a numbing rush, ethereal white light flared out of the sacristy and soared in solid bands down the axes of the city. Every single one of the 999 churches was lit up by the beams. The clerics had been halfway through reading out the anonymic wafers. Now they continued, as burning light suffused their congregations with auras of flame. In the radiance of the old sacristy, the Diadochoi played his hands over the lexicon, declaiming the unwords of power, the anti-language that was Enuncia. He paused and reached up to take off his public guise. The mask of Oscar Ludolf Barazan flopped down to the floor of the dais. The burned, scarred, true face of the Diadochoi was revealed, a vile mass of seared tissue, raw flesh, and lipless teeth. He fanned his hands out, fluttering the spinning metal pages of the lexicon again, and read out the words so revealed. A halo surrounded him. Piece by piece, his body was restored, flesh re-knitting and recreating, gloving his hands in skin, sweeping across his raw skull to re-sculpt a face. Meat, skin, hair, all reformed, bright and new.
"Oh, holy throne!" Kara cried.
"What?" asked Pleiten.
"What is it?"
"It's Moloch," said Carl Phonius.
It's Zygmunt Bastard Moloch!
Chapter 8 Kara and Phonius ran forward into the sacristy, into the almost blinding radiance. Pleiton was right behind them. Their first shots cut down the secretists who tried to prevent them from reaching the dais. Some of the seated guests reacted in alarm, but most were too entranced by the cosmic wonder unfolding at the center of the stage. Carl was first on the platform. His Hecate blazed into the light. Two of the officiating cypherists went down, bright red blood leaking from their bodies across the white platform. The radiant light flickered for a second, and the lexicon vibrated, as if disturbed. Moloch turned, the sudden displeasure on his face changing to a smile as he recognized Carl and Kara behind him. Hand still playing the pages of the lexicon, he formed new unwords that first froze and then evaporated the shots from Carl's pistol and Kara's bolter in mid-air before they could reach him. Then he spoke another unword. The force of it hit them like a wrecking ball. Pleiton was thrown right back off the dais. Kara, hurled into the air, crashed into the raised seating, breaking both it and herself. She felt ribs and collarbone go before pain blacked her out and left her sprawled amongst the broken wreckage of the seats. Carl had taken the full force of the unword. His coat and most of his clothing was shredded off, his skin blistered. His back had hit the platform so hard that it had dented under him. It felt as if all his internal organs had been pulped and his mind set on fire. Carl Thonius screamed, partly in pain, but mostly in helpless fury. They had left it too late. Moloch was now far too powerful for any of them to stop. The unkindness sliced in, and Patience Kiss met it with a las pistol in each hand, and four kind blades orbiting her lean figure. Her telekinetic gifts had never been tested by such a huge and complex threat before, but she didn't falter. The guns began firing, flicking from target to target between shots. Exploded, smoking sheen birds fell out of the rushing formation. The four kind blades swept into the oncoming flock like surface-to-air missiles. She drove each one independently, slicing them through individual birds and immediately on into the next. She also hit the birds themselves with her telekinesis. She caused collisions, impacts that sheared wings off, even hammered some sheen birds beak first into their neighbors like iron nails. In seconds, before the unkindness had even reached her, hundreds of their broken chrome forms littered the flagstones. But there were too many. Too many even for her formidable talents. Suddenly, they were all around her, and she was pushing the swirling mass away from her in every direction as she continued to shoot and stab with her blades. Rips began to appear all over her arms and legs. She heard Unworth, right behind her, cry out in pain as part of the whirling metal blur ripped into his arm. Then another sheen bird struck his forehead, square on, and dropped him to the ground, barely conscious. Concentrating hard, Kiss howled out in frustration. She was killing a dozen birds every second, but it just wasn't enough. She felt a metal flight feather rip across her temple, a beak tear one knuckle, a fluttering chrome edge slice through her left shoulder. Still she fought on, blasting point-blank and sowing her kind blades through the dense storm of bodies. Then she staggered backwards as a bird got past her and hit her in the face. Blood poured down her left cheek. With a desperate grunt, she flared out her telekinesis and billowed the entire flock away from her for a second's respite. But only for a second. It immediately rushed back. She no longer had the strength to drive it away. The phantom with the knife put another deep cut into Nail's body, and he hollered in pain. He was fast for a man of his size, but this half-there demon was a great deal more nimble. The only thing Nail had going for him was experience. He couldn't see his opponent, not well enough to fight back effectively, so he didn't try. He closed his eyes. And there she was. He could smell a sweet female scent that showed him her position as clearly as if he'd seen her. Monica lunged in, her blade about to rip into Nail's liver. A fist hit her instead. She fell, shocked, hurt, suddenly frantic. He was on her, pinning her with his weight. Nail, looking down at the transparent shape he held, pressed to the ground beneath him.
"What are you?" he growled.
For a moment, Monica flashed like a mirror and was him, another Nail looking back at himself. That usually worked. That usually disorientated an opponent quite long enough for her to finish her wet work. Nail looked at himself.
Fancy that,
he said, and broke her neck. Secretist Pholon, spinning his cyber lure, stalked across the square towards the swirling ball of the unkindness, grounded like a dust devil over the flagstones. The shooting from inside the flock had stopped. The targets were undoubtedly dead by now. Pholon felt his spinning lure twitch oddly. It abruptly began to ignore the laws of centrifugal physics. Dragging hard against his struggling arm, it lashed backwards in a whip crack and wrapped 5 times around his throat. Pholon gagged out a terrified gasp. The lure pulled tight, so tight it lifted the secretist off the ground and lynched him in mid-air. The unkindness burst apart, the mass of it exploding away in all directions from the central focus, spilling out across the square, dissipating. It left in its wake thousands of dead or damaged sheen birds, carpeting the flagstones like autumn leaves. And Patience Kiss, still standing, her clothes ragged, her flesh covered in scratches and cuts. She holstered her spent las pistols, mind called her now buckled kind blades back to her, and looked up at the hanged man, dangling in the air. Kiss turned her back on Pholon and let him fall to the ground. She bent down beside Unworth. He was groggy and covered in cuts himself.
"We've got to move," she said.
He nodded and got up. Side by side, they struggled round to the old sacristy. It was lit up, not so much by the massive floodlight arrays, but by the huge beams of white light radiance that poured out of it and blazed away along the axial strands of the city. They hobbled to the doorway. Plighton lay on the threshold, badly knocked about.
"What happened?"
Kiss yelled over the hurricane roar of the light.
"Kara and Thonius are inside," Plighton gasped. "But the man hurt us all bad. I fell. I managed to crawl here."
"What's going on in there?"
"Some kind of ritual," Plighton yelled back. "So bright. So much power."
"We've got to get in," Kiss said.
"That isn't permissive,"
Unworth shouted to her. He'd already tried to walk into the light flaring out of the doorway, but it was like a solid barrier. Kiss pushed her hands against it, felt the light crackle and pulse like a telekinetic field. There was no way in. Carl tried to move, tried to rise. It felt as if the howling light was pushing him down into the decking of the dais. He fought against it, drawing mental strength from his long hatred of Zygmunt Moloch and the shock of seeing the bastard alive. He sat up. His hand still flitting over the lexicon's metal pages, Moloch looked round as he noticed Carl stir. He whispered an unword, almost as if he were blowing Thonius an affectionate kiss. Carl fell backwards, screaming. It felt as if his entrails had been ripped out. Moloch returned to his enunciation. Up in the seating, Kalzean suddenly jumped up.
"Diadochoi! Diadochoi!"
he yelled, trying to make himself heard over the monumental clamor.
"Take your seat!" Trice yelled, getting up too. "How dare you disrupt the—"
"Look! Look, you fool!"
Kalzean bellowed back in his face.
"Look!"
Carl Thonius had risen to his feet. A filthy red light throbbed out of him, backlighting his skin and making silhouettes of his bones. In the ethereal brilliance of the sacristy, he was like a drop of blood in a pail of milk. He raised his right arm, and the flesh crisped away like burning paper, exposing the blackened arm bones and the long fingers that sprouted into talons.
"That's slight," Kalzean stammered. "In the name of darkness, that's slight!"
Chapter 9 Moloch saw what faced him. Disbelief twisted his face. He opened his mouth and blasted the glowing red figure with a stream of enuncia so violent it made the dais shake. Carl withstood it, and his own dark red light seemed to grow stronger, as if he was drinking the power in. He moved forward, his black talons rising. The remaining cipherists broke and fled, except for one who was too slow. Carl's black bone claws shredded him and spattered the white staging with wide patterns of blood. Moloch tried a final unword, but Carl clawed at him. Moloch staggered back across the dais, yowling, the left side of his face torn off. Carl lashed round and ripped his claws through the spinning metal pages of the lexicon, tearing them away. Metal sheets shivered into the air, tumbled out of the suspensor beams, and fluttered onto the deck. Ripped and incomplete, the lexicon itself toppled off its support and crashed to the deck. The storm of noise grew louder, An infernal red quality now began to tinge the white radiance, as if that one drop of blood was staining the milk pink. Tears streaming down his face, Yada Trice ran forward and tried to gather up the torn and buckled pieces of the lexicon. They burned his hands. He looked up. Carl bent down over him and gently placed his black, bone hand on the top of Trice's head, like a temple deacon administering a benediction. Yada Trice rotted away into a dry, mummified husk. Then that, too, disintegrated and scattered away as dust on the wind. Carl turned and moved towards the dignitaries in the seating sections. Most were fleeing for their lives, jumping over the back of the dais.
"Lay!" Kalzean cried. "Cover us, now!"
Layla Slade pulled out her custom handgun and fired 6 times, not at the oncoming demon, but at the dais stage in front of it. As each specialized bullet impacted, there was a burst of green vapor. The hooktors bubbled into being. 6 of them, each one twice the size of a large man, released from their bondage in the painstakingly engraved bullets. They were slaughter demons of Nurgle, mindless warp forms of immense physical power, each one a noxious, sticky cluster of diseased eyes, bulging from a swollen, panting body sack of reptile flesh and pulsing viscera. The hookters moved on tripods of long, membranous limbs, like the furled wings of ancient flying lizards. Each limb culminated in a huge, hooked toenail, a hoof claw as heavy and gray as stone. They made their terrible gibbering. The wretched, fecal stink of them filled the air. Thumping forward on their hideous toenails, they attacked Carl with unthinking frenzy. Kalzean and Slade together grabbed hold of the gravely disfigured Diadochoi.
"Time to go, Lord," Kalzean yelled. "The hookters will hold it off long enough for us to make our escape."
The Diadochoi mumbled out some mangled words, blood pouring from his ripped face.
"No arguments now,"
Kalzean cried. They manhandled the Diadochoi off the dais. Behind them, Carl and the hookters tore each other apart. When Harlan Nail limped into the Grand Templum, the first thing he saw was my support chair, motionless, halfway down the nave. Facing it, 10 meters away, knelt a dark-haired secretist, blood running from his nose and the corners of his staring, stale yellow eyes. Nail knew what this was. He could feel the queasy trembling in the air around him that told him that these 2 motionless figures were engaged in a titanic, invisible battle. As fast as he could move his injured limbs, Nail ran forward, hoping he could slay the secretist psyker while he was still out of his skin and physically vulnerable. The only weapon Nail had was Monica's serrated dagger. Revoke's psi control was staggering. He had left a sliver of his mind aware of his surroundings to protect it from harm. He saw Nail coming forward and barked an unword that punched Nail in the stomach and dropped him to the ground. But not before Nail had hurled the dagger. It stuck through Revoke's right shoulder. Revoke yelped in pain, and his grip on me slipped. I felt the clenching geometric forms loosen ever so slightly as Revoke fought to retain control and grind me to oblivion. All of my mind's power was focused on the one stark desire to pull free. As Revoke's hold slackened, that single impulse squirted out and expressed itself physically instead. For a moment, my entire will channeled itself into the motivator systems of my chair. My armored chair slammed down the nave, crunching straight into Revoke's kneeling body and dragging it along. Revoke was still draped across the front of my chair when it struck the massive bronze altar at the end of the nave at close on 40 kilometers an hour. My chair rebounded, shivering backwards. Revoke's limp, broken corpse tumbled off onto the flagstones. I fought to regain my wits. I was hurt, exhausted, my mind trembling from the agonies of the fight. Back down the nave, Nail was helping the unsteady Belknap to his feet. I powered out through the west entrance and on towards the old sacristy. It was blazing with light, but that light was now stained with red, and the stain was spreading along the sizzling axial beams blasting out across the city. Flames licked at the shattered windows, and sections of the dome, crackling and ablaze, were falling in. Ahead of me, I saw Kiss, Plighton, and Unworth.
"There's no way in," Kiss yelled at me.
"There had to be."
Kara blinked and looked up. The energized wind was shrieking around the buckled dais, and flames were gusting up the sacristy walls, reducing the ancient, precious frescoes of the caving dome to billowing particles of glowing ash. The light was red, not just from the flames, but from the energy radiating from the center of the platform. What had been white and pure was now crimson and thick. She tried to move, but her body was too badly hurt. Bones broken, internal organs flaring with pain.
Oh, God Emperor! Ah! God Emperor!
She gasped out. She turned her head and saw the splattered gore and torn flesh of hook-nailed demon things covering the dais. What the hell had happened while she had been... Carl stood over her. Kara screamed. It wasn't Carl. It was a red luminosity, wearing his body like a robe, lighting his skin from within, exposing his skeleton like a medical scan. His right arm was denuded to the blackened bones, right up to the place where the Hinterlights Medicae had surgically reattached it.
"Oh, throne! Oh, holy throne!"
she cried, terrified. The glowing demon began to reach its taloned hand out towards her.
"Please, Carl, please don't!"
she wailed. The hand hesitated. The red glow inside Carl Thonius diminished for a moment.
"Kara,"
he said, his voice sounding like it was coming from a long way off.
"Oh, Kara, the stuff I know. I can see into your mind. You're afraid of me. You're afraid I'm going to kill you."
Carl's eyelids fluttered. Shock and pain crossed his face.
"No. No. You're dying already. I can see it. That awful lump in your skull. Oh, Kara, no. Not you. Not like that."
Suddenly, the fierce red glow swelled inside him again. His voice became a rasping growl.
"Let me make it better, Kara. Let me finish it quickly."
The black talons swept towards her face. Outside, I saw the light change. It swirled darker, as if gallons of red ink or blood was mixing into it. The axial beams were now almost crimson. I felt the shudder of an enormous psychic force burst inside the collapsing sacristy. "Back!" I cried. "Get back, all of you! Do it!" The ground shook, as if an earthquake was striking. The immense light inside the sacristy went out, leaving nothing but the swirling fire. Every floodlight around the square blew apart in sprays of glass, and the windows of all the buildings around the Grand Templum shattered. The dome of the sacristy ruptured and fell. Flames belched out of the doorways and window holes. The force of the eruption threw my companions into the air and flung my chair backwards. Crackling like forked lightning, the disconnected axial beams boiled out across the city of Petropolis. The 999 temples and churches along Theodore Kaditsky's fearful lines of godless symmetry detonated like bombs, destroying many buildings around them. Firestorms engulfed entire hablocks and stacks. At the Governor's Palace, the monumental energy feedback incinerated the Encompass Room and engulfed the uppermost 20 floors of the tower in a gigantic fireball. It blazed like the raw summit of an angry volcano, hurling white flames up into the blackness of the sky.
Chapter 10. Thousands died that night. Thousands of people, and some of them were innocent imperial citizens, victims caught in the horror and the devastation. To most inhabitants of Eustace Majoris, it was an infamous disaster, a night of cataclysm. Most histories record it that way, too. Certainly, the planet was plunged into civil chaos. Months of rioting and unrest followed, and spread throughout a subsector terrified that imperial rule had been overturned. It led to civil wars, to famines, to plagues. 2 decades later, the effects were still being felt. I content myself with the knowledge that, even at so great a cost, it was a small price to pay. I know what might have been if that cabal of madmen and their ruthless secret keepers had managed to complete their pernicious ritual to acquire the power they craved. Do not presume this means I am happy about the outcome. I deplore the destruction and the deaths. I console myself with the knowledge that every planet in the Imperium would have suffered the same, or worse, had Zygmunt Moloch achieved his apotheosis. Martial law was imposed on Eustace Majoris. It took a year to return Petropolis to a state resembling order. In that time, the Ordos intervened, led by my Lord Rorkin himself. They purged. They cleaned.
They excised the last taints of Yeda Trice's corruption wherever it could be traced. Thousands more died, executed for heresy or complicity to that offence. Subsector governance was switched to Caxton for 2 terms, until a new Lord Governor Subsector was found and elected under the supervision of the Inquisition. Even before the inquisitorial intervention arrived and took charge of the wounded world, I had departed, taking my battered and wounded warriors with me. There was a final business to be dealt with, one that could not wait. Moloch, by Kalzean's manipulative contrivance, had fled Eustace Majoris. We would not rest until we had hunted him down and destroyed him once and for all. Medike Belknap, perhaps the staunchest, truest soul I have ever met, urged me to stay and employ my influence and authority to restore control to the ravaged city. But that is not my area of expertise, and we were the only ones ready and able enough to begin an immediate pursuit of Moloch while he could still be traced. I would not allow him to remain free or escape me once again. He had done that too many times already. We left Eustace Majoris the day after the destruction of the sacristy, travelling aboard Master Unworth's Arethusa. Nail, Patience, and Unworth himself were recovering from their injuries. Maud Plighton came with us, seconded to my service. I was happy to have her. Zael remained in a coma. We transferred him to life support aboard the Arethusa. Frauke seldom left his side. The one miracle in it all, of course, was Kara and Karl. We found them unconscious in the burning ruins of the old sacristy, with barely a scratch on either of them. Somehow, perhaps by the divine providence of the God Emperor himself, they had been spared in that final moment of catastrophe, as the ritual of enunciation tore itself apart. Soon, aboard the Arethusa, in warp transit, 404.M41.
"It's strange," said Belknap.
"Good, though."
The Medicaid nodded.
"Of course. But I've never seen anything like it. The mass is just shrinking, disappearing.
Look, I'm going to the lab to check these results. Perhaps there's a fault with Unworth's rickety old medical systems."
"I hope not," said Kara, sitting up on the infirmary cot.
"So do I," he replied.
"I'll be back in 5 minutes."
"I'm glad you came with us," Kara said.
He looked back at her.
"You're my patient," he said. "I told you that I'd stay with you as long as you needed me."
"Right," she shrugged.
Belknap smiled and coughed.
"What I meant to say was,
I'm glad I came with you too."
He left the infirmary. Kara lay back on the cot, breathed deeply, and closed her eyes.
"Kara?"
She sat up with a start. Karl stood beside her bed.
"Please,"
she began.
"Kara."
His eyes were wide and pleading.
"I'm not going to hurt you. Please, Karl,"
she repeated.
"I have to tell Gideon. I must. I really must."
He reached out his hands, imploring. She shrank back, especially from the right hand.
"Please, Kara,"
he begged.
"If you tell Ravenna, it'll be all over. I need more time, just a little more time. I can master this, understand it, learn to control it."
"No, Karl. Please, Kara. I'm not what you think I am. Would a warp demon have fought against Moloch and destroyed his ritual? Would an evil man have saved you? Would an evil man have cured you?" He touched the side of her head with the fingers of his right hand. She closed her eyes and shuddered.
"I made you better,"
Karl Thonius whispered.
"All I want is for you to help me to get better, too. It's not a lot to ask."
He took his hand away and smiled.
"There. I see it. You won't tell. I know you won't. You won't tell them about..."
His voice trailed off.
"The stuff you know,"
whispered Kara Swole. That was Ravenna Returned. Written by Dan Abnett. Read by Toby Longworth. This recording is copyrighted to Games Workshop 2017.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.